base hit down the left field line. Brett scores.
Rollins Rollins has won it. They stream out of the dugout. Yeah. Rollins by near third. This game is over.
Second deck walk-off home run. Grand slam, Bryce Harper.
That's what I call hitting season.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 532. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about the Hall of Fame vote that came down on Tuesday night. One guy gets in, David Ortiz, the only one. He gets in his first year on the ballot. Not a surprise that Big Poppy got in, but the big story are the guys who didn't get in, and we'll talk about all of that in the next few minutes, and some Phillies that were on the list that managed to survive another year, and of course some who did not. Mike Ferrin from Power Alley on MLB Network Radio is going to join me to talk about the Hall of Fame vote. Plus, we'll also discuss the latest with the labor wars, and we'll dip our toes into some Phillies conversation as well. And then after that, I want to talk about reasonable expectations for the Phillies starting rotation in 2022. That's all coming up here on this edition of Hittin' Season. So let's talk about the Hall of Fame voting. The Baseball Writers Association of America have voted. They have had their say. They have made their piece. And they have said that David Ortiz, receiving 307 votes and 77.9% of the vote, was the only person worthy of being elected on the Hall of Fame ballot this year. He gets in on his first year on the ballot, just clears the 75% threshold. There were obviously a lot of folks who did not think David Ortiz should have gotten in because his name had been tangentially linked to a report that came out in 2003 about PED tests and positive tests. But even the league itself said those tests were not conclusive and you really shouldn't have drawn anything, any kind of firm opinion on who was using and who wasn't from that specific list. And other than that, David Ortiz has never been linked to performance-enhancing drugs. You also had some other people who didn't think that a designated hitter, at least not one of Ortiz's accomplishments, should have gotten into the Hall of Fame. I absolutely think Ortiz was a Hall of Famer when you factor in his play on the field and the personality that he was. And see, I think all of these things are intangibles, his postseason heroics, the personality, how much he meant to one of the most important organizations in baseball, the Boston Red Sox. All of that stuff has to be taken into consideration because it's the Hall of Fame, not the Hall of Stats. And we get so wrapped up in statistics that sometimes we lose the greater narrative around players. And so I agree with the Baseball Writers Association of America that they say David Ortiz should be in the Hall of Fame. However, he was the only one to get the 75% necessary. And for three guys who were in their final years on the ballots, three of the top five guys, vote getters, were in their final year on the ballot and did not get in. Of course, baseball's single season home run king, baseball's all time home run king, and the guy who most think is the best baseball player who ever lived, Barry Bonds, finishes at 66%. Far short of the 75% needed. I honestly thought he'd get in this year. I really did. Before the whole process started, I really thought there was enough momentum for Barry Bonds to be elected into the Hall of Fame, but he falls well short at 66%. And it seems Bonds and Clemens, Roger Clemens, were always joined at the hip here. If you voted for Bonds, you voted for Clemens. If you voted for Clemens, you voted for Bonds. There was only a 3-vote difference between the two, and it's mirrored. That has been mirrored basically every year these guys have been on the ballot. Roger Clemens finishes with 65.2% of the vote. And then the other guy in his final year on the ballot, Curt Schilling, came in 5th in the voting. He saw a massive drop in his support, just 58.6% in this, his final year on the ballot. In fact, Curt Schilling saw a drop of 12.5% from last year to this year after saying he didn't want to be on the ballot anymore. And of course, a lot of the controversial remarks and things that he has said, people just lost their taste for voting. Voting a pitcher like Curt Schilling, who, based on his on-field resume, should be a Hall of Famer, but isn't because of all of the nonsense that he does off the field. Scott Rolen finished with the 4th highest vote percentage at 63.2 in his 5th year on the ballot, and he is really trending in the right direction. He had the biggest voting change from last year to this year, and that's with all of these super stud players who were in their last year on the ballot. Once those guys move off, Rolen might get in next year. He was up 10.3% from last year to this year, even with the logjam. So the narrative around Scott Rolen seems to be trending in the direction of him getting into the Hall of Fame next year. Then you had Todd Helton at 52%, Billy Wagner at 51%, Andrew Jones, who I absolutely think should be in the Hall of Fame, and his fifth year on the ballot is at 41.1%, Gary Sheffield at 40.6%. He's in his eighth year on the ballot. He's only got two more cracks at it. A-Rod, in his first year on the ballot, finished with the second most votes out of anybody in their first year on the ballot at 34.3%. Followed by Jeff Kent at 32.7%. He has one more year. Jeff Kent's last year to get voted in is next year. And he would need quite a leap up in order to do that from 32.7% to 75%. Manny Ramirez was at 28.9%. Omar Vizquel saw a huge drop in his numbers, the biggest of anybody from last year's ballot to this one. He finished with just 23.9% of the vote. That was down 25 percentage points, and that's because of the sexual assault scandal that has been following him from when he was a coach in the minors. Sammy Sosa, in his final year on the ballot, finishes with just 18.5%. And I guess the reason Sammy Sosa is so far below Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens is, I think with Bonds and Clemens, most people believe that those guys were Hall of Famers before they started taking steroids. I think most folks believe, and I probably tend to agree, although I would have voted Sammy Sosa in, I think people believe that the only reason we talk about Sammy Sosa as a Hall of Fame player is because of steroids, that he would not have been a Hall of Fame player without steroids. Of course, this was a time when the league, yes, said they were bad, but, you know, didn't really check up on anybody. So I'm not holding that against Sammy Sosa. And I'm looking at a guy who hit over 60 home runs as many times as he did in a season and over 600 home runs in his career, and I'm putting him in the Hall of Fame. But he only had the support of 18.5% of the writers, and so he is off the ballot. And then you got Andy Pettitte at 10.7%. Again, he's linked to PEDs, but I think his support should be a lot higher, but he'll stick around for another season. Jimmy Rollins, in his first year on the ballot, finished with the third most votes of all of the first-time players at 9.4%. 37 people voted for him, and so he will remain on the ballot for another season, as will Bobby Abreu at 8.6% in his third year on the ballot. Abreu actually finished with fewer votes than Jimmy Rollins did, which I thought was kind of interesting. And then you have some other Phillies of note on the list here. Ryan Howard got just 2% of the vote. 8 people voted for Ryan Howard, so he is one and done, as is Jonathan Papelbon. Just 5 people voted him into the Hall of Fame at 1.3%. So that's how the voting shook out. Again, I thought that the Jimmy Rollins numbers were better than I thought. I thought he would just scrape by the 5%, and he actually came close to 10%. I'm surprised. I think Jimmy Rollins is more deserving of the Hall of Fame than Bobby Abreu, but I know that there are people who feel differently about that, and I thought there were more. So I'm surprised Abreu finished behind Rollins in the voting this year. And of course, one of the things I want to ask Mike about when he joins us is, what are the chances Rollins can make his way up to 75% over the next 9 years? We saw a guy like Tim Raines make his way up. Scott Rolen has been doing that. There are players where the narrative surrounding these guys, when you are able to look at what they did at their particular position in the era in which they played and compare it to the guys to the peers of their generation, and even historically over time at that position, you look at some of the things Jimmy Rollins did, and they were just special. We talked about him a couple of weeks ago here on the podcast. He was a distinctly unique player. And I think that's one of the reasons why I have been convinced this year that he should be in the Hall of Fame. When he retired, I did not think Jimmy Rollins was a Hall of Fame player. But this is why I think we have to allow writers to change their minds on these guys, and why you can vote for two guys and let that be your ballot. You can vote for no guys and let that be your ballot. You can vote for 10 guys and let that be your ballot. There shouldn't be any restrictions on how many people you can vote for, but there are. And so as long as you can back it up, as long as you have a reason, you can vote however you want. Writers can vote however they want. I did note that the AP's Rob Motti, a friend of the podcast, and now he's their senior NFL writer, but he still gets votes for the baseball writer. He's still a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America as the Phillies beat writer for the AP for many years. And he said, take the vote away from us. He doesn't think the Baseball Writers Association of America should continue to be the ones holding the golden goose here. And I can't say I disagree. And one of the things I want to talk about with Mike here in just a second is if that's the case, what's the alternative? If the voting system is broken, and I'm not sure that he feels that it is, but if the voting system is broken, how do we fix it? Because I think it's crazy that you have baseball's all-time home run king who will not be in a baseball museum. I mean, there are some items from Barry Bonds in the Hall of Fame. So he's represented there. But when you go into the room where all the enshrined players are, and you don't have the greatest home run hitter in baseball history, you don't have the guy many consider to be the greatest player in baseball history, you know, you don't have someone who was so good that they intentionally walked him with the bases loaded in a real American baseball game. Like, that actually is something that happened. The fact that he's not in the Hall of Fame, I mean, I get being upset. I see this a lot. He's a liar and a cheater. And if you're one of the people who believe that, I just think we have to look at the time in which he played, where players were rewarded for taking steroids, for taking BEDs. PEDs, not BEDs. PEDs. Players were rewarded for it. PEDs saved baseball, guys. Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire saved baseball. It wasn't Cal Ripken breaking the consecutive games played record. That helped. That got baseball off life support. But it was the home run chase that made nightly news on the evening newscast. Can you imagine baseball leading the evening news, being the number one topic of discussion across the country, like it was for the final 2 months of the 2000, what was it? The 1998 season. Can you imagine that? McGwire and Sosa saved baseball. Steroids saved baseball. I'm glad they're gone. I'm glad they have rules in place now to get rid of it, because they did make a joke of the rule book. But let's not pretend that it wasn't sanctioned by Major League Baseball, even though they'll say it wasn't, but it was. And so penalizing these guys for doing what Major League Baseball let them do, essentially, I just don't agree with. If you disagree, I get it. But I think the reason Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens are not in the Hall of Fame is because people see them as being bad guys, right? If I saw this argument on Twitter, and I think it's right. I think Britt Grioli of the Athletic said this. If Barry Bonds had David Ortiz's personality, Barry Bonds would be in the Hall of Fame, and I agree with that. Same with Roger Clemens. I really do agree with that. And let's talk about Roger Clemens. Roger Clemens is the only pitcher in Major League Baseball history to win 7 Cy Young Awards. 7 Cy Youngs. He also has an MVP. I mean, my goodness, he won 7 Cy Young Awards before, I mean, he had 3 Cy Young Awards before 1996. By the time 1997 rolled around, when he was in his age 34 season, when he went to Toronto, he won 2 straight Cy Young Awards in Toronto at age 34 and 35. Cy Young Awards number 4, and number 5. Now, I don't know, you know, to what effect the steroids had on his late career. I mean, the dude pitched until he was 44 years old and was an all-star. He won his final Cy Young at 41 years old, led the National League in ERA at 1.87 for the Houston Astros in 2005 in their World Series season. No, that wasn't their World Series. Yeah, it was their World Series season in 2005. Finished 3rd in the Cy Young vote that year. I mean, I just feel like these are guys that should be in the Hall of Fame. It's a baseball museum. It's a place where you go to learn about the history of baseball. And whitewashing these players is just silly. But because you have personal grudges, you have personal animus from the writers, the people who are supposed to vote these guys in. Now, I will say, and I did think that this was interesting, I think it's mostly an older school writer thing. Because I thought Jason Stark had this, it was an amazing tweet that he had, an amazing stat that he had from his piece in The Athletic that I think that came out on Wednesday morning. Bonds and Clemens got 86% of the vote among voters who joined the Baseball Writers Association electorate in the last 5 years. Right? So of all of the writers who have joined in the last 5 years, who have been allowed to participate in the voting process from the Baseball Writers Association of America, they got 86% of the vote. It's clear the younger writers believe that Bonds and Clemens should be in the Hall of Fame. It's the older writers that don't. And so the old rules used to be you were on the ballot for 15 years, not 10. We've shrunk that down now. If it was 15 years, I guarantee you Bonds and Clemens would be on. Maybe not till year 13 or 14, but certainly by year 15. And so now you have baseball's all-time hits leader, Pete Rose, not in the Hall of Fame for gambling on his own team, which, again, wrong. He should have been banned from baseball for life. No doubt about it. But that doesn't mean he had to be excluded from the Hall of Fame. I don't like Pete Rose any more than you do. I think he's a scoundrel. No doubt about it. There are lots of scoundrels in the Hall of Fame. Ty Cobb's in the Hall of Fame, guys. There are a lot of scoundrels in the Hall of Fame. And yes, he bet on baseball. But put that on the plaque. Make it the first thing. Put it in extra gold bold or whatever it is you want to do with it. But the all-time hit king should be in the Hall of Fame. The all-time home run king should be in the Hall of Fame. The all-time Cy Young leader should be in the Hall of Fame. Otherwise, what kind of a museum is this? And I get it. It's an honor to be enshrined, and you don't want to privilege these players who have done quote-unquote bad. You don't want to give them the honor of the enshrinement. I think it makes a joke of the Hall of Fame. I think it makes it a joke of the museum. And I think that's kind of where we are with it right now. So I'm going to stop yapping about this because I'm not making any arguments you all haven't heard before. I do want to talk to Mike Farren about this from MLB Network Radio. He's going to join us in just a minute to talk about the Hall of Fame vote. We'll also talk about the latest on the labor wars, and we'll talk about some Philly stuff as well. That's all coming up next here on Hittin' Season. And joining me to talk about the Baseball Hall of Fame voting, and we'll talk a little bit of the labor wars as well. Maybe we'll dip our feet into some Philly stuff. We'll see what kind of time we have left. Mike Farren, who's the co-host of Power Alley on MLB Network Radio on Sirius XM. Always good to talk to you, Mike. Mike, one of the OGs of this podcast back when we were the Felsky Files. Good to talk to you, and how are you, buddy?
It is true. It has been a long-running partnership, I would say,
John. Yeah. It's back into 2015, so I can't believe you're still with me. I appreciate you, pal. So anyway, let me just get your first thoughts on the Hall of Fame voting, because, I mean, obviously this was not controversial for who was elected, obviously, but it was more controversial about who was not elected. But let's get to those guys in just a second. First, let's give Big Poppy his due. Your thoughts on Big Poppy getting in on his first year on the ballot?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad because I've been a David Ortiz supporter. I think he's, you know, obviously one of the most important figures in the last 20 years of baseball history. You think about how many huge moments he's had on some of the biggest stages, and then add to it that you've got a guy with 500 home runs and, you know, who was essentially an on-base machine who hit for power and in the middle of the lineup on perennial contenders. It's great. I think it's a well-deserved honor. You know, personally, he's one of my favorite personalities that I've ever covered. He's just like what you see in every interview and everything that he does on TV now on Fox and all of that is not an act. And he has this unique ability of making you feel like you've known him for your entire life, even if you're somebody who rarely covers him. He's just a really warm, gregarious person. And so I, you know, in addition to him being a great player, seeing somebody who, you know, I have a lot of respect for as a person, seeing him get in, I think it was very exciting.
And I think with Big Poppy, one of the things that I think is true for some of these guys who may end up on the outside looking in, I think personality does go into this. You know, I think some of the narrative, you know, we get so focused on the statistics when we're talking about Hall of Fame people. And you know, that's legit. You know, you want to compare numbers. You want to look at that kind of stuff. But it's the Hall of Fame, not necessarily the Hall of Stats. I think the effect that these guys have on the game itself, if there's ever a question, should factor into it. You know, like the David Ortiz, when you think about baseball of a certain era, it's really hard to tell the story of baseball in the 2000s without David Ortiz.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I necessarily agree that the personality was a driving factor in it. I mean, I think, listen, there are plenty of guys who were terrible to deal with, or bad guys that got in on the first ballot. I mean, I just don't think that's the case with Ortiz. And I think it's, you know, it's more that he has in addition to having the counting stats, he has these hugely identifiable moments, whether it's, you know, the walk-off game, home run in game five of the American League Championship Series, right? Or the walk-off home run in game four, and then the game-winning hit in game five. I can't remember what order it was back in 04, or helping the 07 team to the World Series, or literally like carrying the city of Boston on its back. And you know, I'd forgotten until this morning, to my radio partner, Jim Duquette, reminded me. We were at the ALCS in 2013, and you know, the Red Sox looked like they were dead in the water until Ortiz hit the grand slam off Joaquin Benoit. He only had two hits in that series. He was like 2 for 22. And then in the World Series he hit almost 700. So like, there's these like huge moments that he's a part of, that I think help to fill in, you know, some of the other stuff that goes into, you know, evaluating a player where voters have not been particularly kind to designated hitters. You know, he has, I think Jason Stark had this morning that he has the highest percentage of games played of a DH ever for anyone ever. I mean, not in baseball history, but in the history of Hall of Fame. And it's significantly more than Edgar Martinez. And so, you know, I think when you start looking at those, it's a unique case, but it's one that has not just the counting stats, but those moments that are iconic. And that certainly is part of Ortiz.
So most of the story now, once the vote came out and we saw that Barry Bonds didn't get in his last year on the ballot, Roger Clemens didn't get in his last year on the ballot, Curt Schilling did not get in, Sammy Sosa did not get in his year on the ballot. Sosa was never really close to 75%, but the other three guys were. And you now have a situation where with the Hall of Fame, you don't have the all-time hits leader in there and Pete Rose, for better or worse, whatever the opinion is on whether Pete should be in there. That's a separate discussion. But you've got the all-time home run leader not in there in Bonds. You've got the all-time Cy Young leader in Roger Clemens not in there. As a baseball museum, you these guys are not in there. And I know the younger voters, Bonds and Clemens were kind of trending up. So it used to be a 15-year process on the ballot. It was shortened to 10 years, and that seems to have really hurt Bonds and Clemens with getting left off the ballot. Now, what are your thoughts on those two guys specifically missing out on the Hall of Fame?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been supporters of both of their candidacies because I think they're two of the greatest players of all time. And I guess I probably fit into that younger voter category, even though I'm in my mid-40s. But, you know, I think I don't know that another 5 years would have helped them all that much. I know that's been popular today, but their support had really kind of flatlined over the last several years. And while new voters, and I think it's what 51 of the 59 have been added over the last 5 years, voted for them. That's like 86%. I think that was in Jason Stark again this morning. I'm not sure that it necessarily would have been enough. I mean, you look at the public facing ballots today or yesterday, which was about half the electorate, you know, had them at trending about 76 or 77%. And it was just over half of the remaining voters that voted for them. You know, it's 52% of those who didn't release their result or their votes before the election. And so I'm not sure that they would have otherwise. I mean, listen, their cases are fraught, right? Like there is no, I don't think there's a right answer in this. I mean, Bonds, you know, while he ended up not being convicted by federal prosecutors, you know, was the subject of a really long, drawn out, you know, steroid use that dated back to the late 90s or early 2000s, if you read Game of Shadows.
Right.
In addition to it, you know, he was accused in court of spousal abuse. You know, Clemens, in addition to his link in the Mitchell report, you know, his subsequent testimony and charges of perjury in front of Congress also had a relationship with an underage, you know, country singer when he was playing in Boston, you know. So, you know, these cases are very, very complicated. And when you start, you know, everybody is going to apply something like the character clause differently. So it applies to whether or not it's while they played or whether it was just their on-field actions or, you know, if you take after they were done playing, you know, incidents that may have occurred, which is similar to what happened with Schilling or in the case of Omar Vizquel, who also has been charged with domestic assault and sexual harassment now. You know, all of those things, I think, are difficult to factor in, and there is no perfect answer to it. And as much much as I thought, you know, Bonds and Clemens and Schilling as performers were Hall of Famers, I also understand that, you know, there are two things at play. One, that everybody's, you know, tolerance of what constitutes good character is going to be different. And two, it's very difficult to get 75% of a large body of people, in this case, 400 voters, to agree on anything. Yeah. So I think when you factor all of that together, you're right. I mean, I think it's, you know, I think there are ways that this could have happened where we weren't necessarily running from baseball's history with specifically with steroids. Mm-hmm. But, it, you know, the fact that it hasn't now puts it in the hands really of the Hall of Fame and the Veterans Committee. And I'll be as curious to see the makeup of that Veterans Committee as anything.
Are too few former players getting into the Hall of Fame nowadays?
Yes.
It should. It's the small hall thing is not a thing that's ever really been a thing, right?
Well, I mean, it's all relative, right? So yeah. It's like, is it 1.5% or is it 1%? And I think with the number of players, you know, expanding over the last 60 years, you know, with the first expansion 61 till now, you know, you have nearly twice as many players as we're playing in you know, the pre-1960 era. And, you know, remember only 15 years of that in pre-expansion, 15 seasons were integrated. And right. Some of the, and you know, 1947 was barely integrated. I mean, right. It was Jackie Robinson and you know, Larry Doby. And I think there may have been one or two other black players that first got their chance in 47, but those were the two prominent ones. So, yeah. I think there's been some research that's shown that it's a lower percentage that's getting in. I think Ben Lindbergh and Travis Sawchuk have done that. And I think, you know, with that in mind, I think that there is, even if you were to take away or try and limit from the controversial characters like the three we've talked about and Pete Rose, that there are a number of players that should be in the Hall of Fame based on their performance and their celeb while they played versus, you know, where they are now. The electorate has done too good a job in my mind of keeping people out. And they're, you know, and it's fine to say, hey, listen, we have these era committees, which is what, you know, I still call them the veterans committees, but really they're the era committees that right. are supposed to be fail safes for this. But, you know, the writers are voting in a lower percentage than they ever have before as well. And yeah. that I think is, you know, part of that, that's something that I would like to see further study on. So I'm not a huge fan of some of the things that they do with the era committees. And I don't want it to go back to being the Frankie Frisch era where they just let everybody in that was a teammate of Frankie Frisch. But I think that there's some things in their process that doesn't focus enough on people who are still alive where they get a chance to enjoy being in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the best failsafe we have for now. I think, you know, with a new president of the Hall, who's open to modernizing the entire Hall of Fame and museum. I think it'll be a couple of years before he has enough data to be able to make some decisions or convince his bosses to make some decisions that alter things. But I'm hopeful that things will start to move in a little bit different process as we get down the road.
Rob Motti of the Associated Press tweeted something out I thought was interesting. He was the beat writer for the Phillies for the AP for a number of years. Now he does, obviously he's their head football guy, but he wrote, obviously displeased about the Bonds and Clemens situation. And I think a number of other players that he felt that the vote should be taken away from he and the writers. And I think we agree that will never happen, but do you think the pool of voters needs to change in some way? And if so, how do we change the pool?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, if Rob has issue and he is a voter with the way the voting roll goes, I mean, he can choose not to vote. I mean, I think we've seen some prominent writers do that. We know that there are some publications that don't allow their writers to vote. The Washington Post, the New York Times, Baltimore Sun, traditionally Los Angeles Times have done that. As for whether or not or how it might change, I don't know that I have a good answer for it. I mean, I think the idea behind it is that the writers are independent, right? They're not employed by teams.
Right.
They're not employed by the league, although that is changing too with MLB.com and those writers being allowed into the Baseball Writers Association of America. And theoretically, they are the ones who are at the ballpark every day paying attention and have the most sources. So, you know, are they the best people to do it? I think they are among the best people to do it. Are there other people that could? I guess theoretically, but I think if you're going to do something like that, then you're looking at a process that's far closer to what either the error committees or the NFL does for their Hall of Fame, where it's committee based versus having a giant electorate. I don't think, you know, first of all, I mean, I think adding broadcasters, which is one that comes up a lot, I think that's a mistake just on principle, because about half of the broadcasters actually are employed by teams. Yeah. And so you start running that risk there. And I think while there are a number of broadcasters that I would love to, you know, hear their opinions on, I don't think just adding them in solves it. I don't think that's also the case with the players or Hall of Fame players. I mean, you may remember that in the early 2000s, the Veterans Committee was changed to be just Hall of Famers that were voting, and they skunked people for nearly a decade.
Yeah.
So like, there is no perfect answer to any of this. None of the solutions are perfect. I would like to see, rather than us spitballing ideas like it's a sports talk radio show, to see the Hall actually, if they wanted to change the process, do some research on it.
Last thing on the Hall for you. I got to ask about Jimmy Rollins, who I think had a better showing than I expected.
Yeah, me too.
I thought he'd just barely crack five. He got almost 10%. I'm surprised he finished above Bobby Abreu in the voting as well, even though I like Rollins' candidacy more than Abreu. I think they're both worthy, but I was surprised by Rollins being slightly ahead of Bobby. What do you think the chances are Rollins makes his way up to 75% in the next 9 years? It seems it seems hard to fathom to me, but I was surprised by the 9.4%.
Yeah, I mean, I was too. I mean, nearly, you know, the 5% is the threshold to drop off the ballot. I mean, listen, I think, you know, he's got an MVP award, multiple time All-Star, you know, one of the premier two-way shortstops of his era. I'm not sure that I necessarily view him as being a guy that's going to have the statistical community behind him, which seems to have been the driving force in a number of these. Now, that said, Vizquel had been gaining for a long time before this year, and he was not a darling of the statistical community. So there is a chance that, as because of the position that he played and being a power hitter, you know, for at least a chunk of his career and having a great peak, that Rollins continues to gain, especially in the absence of another, you know, surefire Hall of Fame shortstop, save for Alex Rodriguez, who has his own laundry list of issues that he carries onto the ballot. So I would view Rollins' candidacy probably more in the likes of a Don Mattingly, that kind, you know, where he, you know, maybe he ends up peaking in the 20s or 30 percentage wise, but doesn't seem to garner much more support than that, even with Jason Stark pounding the table.
Yeah, I found it interesting. I saw a lot of the stats guys surprisingly supporting a Rollins candidacy because his numbers are so unique for shortstops, the mix of power and speed and all that kind of stuff. It's an interesting case. I didn't, before this year, before some of those articles came out, I did not think Rollins was a Hall of Famer, and they started to convince me a little bit.
I mean, I think you're going to start to see, like, you know, if they were going to coalesce behind somebody, I think the hope was it was going to be Abreu.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that there's enough there. I mean, listen, you're going to see, you know, some of those guys that had really good days that didn't get into the Hall of Fame are like Scott Rolen, who, you know, keep crossing what, 63%. I mean, there's a good chance that he goes into the Hall of Fame next year. Billy Wagner is another one who got over the 50% threshold, which is significant. Todd Helton as well. You know, those are guys that I think are going to be next in line. And, you know, one thing that Rollins has going for him that a number of the other candidates on the ballot do as well is that there's just not that many surefire Hall of Famers that are coming up. I mean, you know, Adrian Beltre in 2023. You know, probably has a pretty good chance. Maybe he goes in as a first ballot guy. CC Sabathia in 2025. You know, this coming year, Carlos Beltran is going to be on it, who I think is a Hall of Famer. But the issues with the Astros in 2017 are likely going to be front and center.
Yeah.
And if people aren't voting for Manny Ramirez and Alex Rodriguez because they were suspended for PED use, even though they're in good standing with the league, you would think that they would apply the same logic to Beltran. But we'll see, because logic doesn't always show up when it comes to Hall of Fame vote.
Yeah. All right. Let me ask you a real quick question about the labor wars. We saw the two sides get together for a couple days this week. They traded some offers back and forth. Generally speaking, it seemed like some progress was made. I mean, they didn't get up from the table throwing lawn darts at each other. So I guess that's a plus. But what are your thoughts on the current state of the labor negotiations right now?
Well, they're happening. I think that's,
that's half the battle.
you know, I think it's, I think what we've learned, or at least this has been my takeaway, is that, boy, they really had a lot of work to do going into this. And generally, I think, you know, they had their first meetings on this CBA back in July of 2019. And the problem is that for most of 2020 and the first part of 2021, the league and the players had a much more pressing issue in getting a season on the field. And, you know, we understand the rancor that happened in 2022, but just in terms of having to deal with COVID protocols and building something that was safe potentially for both sides to be able to play, took a huge amount of bandwidth, you know? So I think what we've seen is that it's played out more publicly than normal. But I think it's probably, at least it feels a little bit earlier in the process. You know, when you start seeing things like them banding about years for free agency and doing away with arbitration and those kind of things that aren't, you know, aren't going to be part of the next collective bargaining agreement, that aren't going to change, come up, it probably tells you that we're not very far along in the process. So I think that's probably part of it. I think the calendar got them a little bit in that regard. You know, I'm not sure that the lockout actually did what the commissioner said it was going to in getting the parties to the table faster, but we're starting to reach some real deadlines here in getting spring training started. And I think an important date that's coming up is February 8th to the 10th. There are going to be owners meetings in Orlando. And if they want to have spring training happen largely uninterrupted, it would seem by right around then they would need to get something finished. So we'll keep an eye on that over the next couple of weeks. The progress has been incremental, but the more they meet, the better chance they have of getting a resolution.
All right, last thing for you here, Mike. Just real quick on the Phils. Things kind of froze once the lockout went into place. The Phillies made a couple of small moves around the edges here, but they've still got a lot of work to do. Right now, they have two outfielders on their big league roster. I don't think Matt Vierling can play both left and center field. So they've got some work to do still. And I guess we saw the Mets were really busy. The Braves won the division three times in a row. What is really important for the Phillies to get done once the lockout ends in order for them to compete?
Well, they need an outfielder or two.
Yes. I agree. Mean,
I think there were some times that Matt Vierling may have played left and center last
year. Yeah, that's right.
Like it when McCutchen was dealing with some injuries, but
right.
You know, I think they could use a couple of different things. I actually really like their rotation. It's not super deep. They could use a little bit of a depth starter. They could use some bullpen depth. Although I really like the Corey Knebel signing. I think he's a good candidate to bounce back. And then they need, you know, a couple of outfielders really, or to figure out if there's a way that, you know, if Bryson Stott is the guy, then they can, you know, potentially move Didi to third theoretically. And, you know, maybe Baum moves to the outfield, or you're going to have to fill a DH slot as well. So, you know, and you'd like to have that with some semblance of a competent offensive piece. So I really think outfield has to be most of the focus. I mean, we heard the trade rumors with Kiermaier. I think he makes a lot of sense, even though he's not a huge upgrade offensively. This was not a good defensive team a year ago either.
No.
And Kiermaier's a terrific defensive center fielder. So, you know, I think if Stott's going to end up playing most of the games at shortstop, I think he'll be better defensively than Gregorius, although I don't view him as a gold glove type. But that should help to stabilize things. You know, I think if Baum either shows improvement working with Bobby Dickerson, the new infield instructor, mm-hmm. or they decide to move him to a spot where he can focus more on his bat and they can improve that defensively at third, I think that would be another thing that they can help. But, you know, they're pretty well positioned to be a competitive team. I mean, they've been competitive the last couple of years. They just haven't been able to get over the hump. But I like their rotation. I mean, I like the guys that they're going to run out there. I think Nola's a great candidate for bounce back. I don't think Wheeler's going to be quite to the level that he was this year, but he's still pretty damn good.
Yeah.
And so, like, you've got a puncher's chance. And Ranger Suarez was great. I mean, I got to see him pitch a couple times last year. Man, is he impressive. So, you know, if you can continue to build on that, I think they'll be competitive. They'll be in the mix. And it's just a matter of, you know, how much they're able to either move players around to try and reallocate some financial resources to upgrade those spots, or if ownership just says, okay, let's push forward and let's add, you know, outfielders via trade or free agency that can help boost this offense.
Well, hopefully the Phillies can start to get some moves made here. Hopefully this lockout ends relatively soon. We get some labor stuff taken care of, and We can all not kill each other over the Hall of Fame here in baseball Twitter land. Folks, check out everything Mike Farron has going on over at MLB Network Radio. Check him out every day as the co-host of Power Alley with Jim Duquette over at SiriusXM. Mike, follow him on Twitter. Also, by the way, at @Mike_Farron. Mike, thanks for coming on Hitting Season, man. It's always good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you too, John. Take care.
Well, one other thing I wanted to touch on before we wrapped up the podcast, a piece I wrote for The Good Fight recently, talking about what I think are realistic expectations for the Phillies rotation in 2022. I think we're all coming into this season believing that the starting rotation is probably the strength of this team. Now, we don't know what they're going to do to fill out the outfield yet. We don't know what free agents they might sign. I think we have a good idea of maybe one or two guys, but we don't know if they're going to make any trades to help fix the infield. We don't know what the bullpen is going to finish looking like just yet. They don't have a lot of money to spend, so they're going to have to get creative if they want to fix all their holes, and you know, who knows if they're going to be able to do all that. There's just so much about this team we still don't know. But I think one area in which the Phillies are not likely to tinker between now and opening day is the starting rotation. Barring something unforeseen, the rotation for 2022 appears to be set. You've got Zach Wheeler, Aaron Nola, Ranger Suarez, Kyle Gibson, and then for the number five spot, you'll have Zach Eflin if he's ready in time. If not, then you're probably looking at Hans Kraus or Bailey Falter making starts in the number five spot. Again, assuming one of those guys is not moved in a trade of some kind between now and then. Maybe Dombrowski adds an additional starter to give you some depth, but it's unlikely to be one on a major league deal like they gave Chase Anderson or Matt Moore last year. It's mostly going to be some minor league invite, spring training invitees, and you know, the horses that this team already has are probably the ones that they're going to leave the starting gate with on opening day, whenever that may be. But I think we should be kind of thinking about, when we're looking at this rotation as the team's strength, we as Phillies fans want to think the best of each of these pitchers and that they will perform that way. And certainly there's a chance that could happen. There is absolutely a chance that Zach Wheeler could put in another Cy Young performance. Like, we've seen Zach Wheeler make the leap, and that's what he's going to be from now on. A perennial Cy Young candidate. That is certainly a possibility. He was absolutely dominant last year. He looked like one of the three or five best pitchers in the sport. He finished second in the Cy Young. I think he should have won based on his durability and how many innings he pitched combined with his productivity. If you look at some of the projections, most see him as a guy with an ERA about between 3.2 and 3.4. Last year, he was worth seven wins. They're most likely see him as like a 4-5 win pitcher this year, 4-4.5 win pitcher this year. And I think when you look at projections like Steamer and Zips and Marcel, which is what Baseball Reference uses, they mostly try to aim conservative. So maybe you can bump those numbers up a little bit. But the best case scenario is, of course, Zach Wheeler repeating his Cy Young performance. The best case scenario for Aaron Nola is for Aaron Nola to rediscover what went missing last year. Remember, going into last year, Aaron Nola was the team's ace, and he was a finalist for the Cy Young Award a couple of seasons ago. We know that kind of pitcher is in there. Consistency has been his problem. I think Aaron Nola is a guy who will bounce back this year. You can look at some of his peripherals, and you see a guy whose strikeouts per nine were higher than Zach Wheeler's last year, 11.11 strikeouts per nine. His walks per nine were the lowest of his career. He only walked 1.94 guys per nine innings last year. He did not lose because of walks. His fielding independent pitching of 3.37 gave him a WAR, an FWAR of 4.5. Like, that's really good. But we also saw a guy who got burned with two strikes, who could not execute pitches with two strikes and with two outs. He gave up a ton of home runs, a career-high 1.3 homers per nine last year. And one of the big things that hurt him last year is he stopped throwing ground balls. He's a career 48.7% ground ball percentage guy. Last year, he threw ground balls at just a 40.5% rate. And Nola himself couldn't figure it out. So what do the projections look like for him? Most of the projections see a slight improvement, but nothing phenomenal. About 10 strikeouts per nine, about 2.5 walks per nine. So they see the strikeouts coming down, the walks going up a little bit. Not many people seeing a drop in the home run rate, to be perfectly honest with you, but most folks seem to think that his 4.63 ERA was artificially inflated, and we're looking mostly at an ERA probably in the mid to upper threes. That's a 3.5 to 4 win player. So a slightly fewer WAR player than Zach Wheeler based on the projections, but that's about what they're looking at for Aaron Nola. But again, you could look at a high-end Aaron Nola. If you get Zach Wheeler and Aaron Nola both pitching up to their capabilities, that's a dominant top two. And then you get Ranger Suarez, who I think is such an enigma. What a question mark going into the season. He basically was a guy who, over the last 3 months, was perhaps the best left-handed starting pitcher in baseball. He made 12 starts last year, 39 appearances overall, with a 1.36 ERA in 106 innings. Hear that, 1.36 in 106 innings. That was a 3.0 FWAR for him. He had the highest ERA plus last year of any pitcher with at least 100 innings at 3.08. The next closest, Carlos Rodon, at 1.83. I mean, you talk about the separation between Ranger Suarez and the rest of the pitchers with at least 100 innings pitched. Suarez at 3.08, Rodon 1.83, Burns, Corbin Burns 1.76, Brandon Woodruff 1.66, Max Scherzer 1.66. Ranger Suarez was crazy last year. And his 1.36 ERA was the lowest among all pitchers with at least 100 innings. The next closest was Rodon at 2.37, a full run higher. So we know Suarez isn't doing a 1.36 again. But would everybody be thrilled, and I think you should be, if you get a season of 25 to 27 starts from him with a 3.36 ERA? Like, let's say his ERA goes up two runs. 3.36 for Ranger Suarez, a full season of him as your number three starter? Absolutely sign me up for that. Now, most of the projections see something a little higher, something in the upper threes to low fours, looking at more of a two-win player. That's not great for a number three starter. You'd like to get a little more from your number three starter on a playoff team, if that's to be believed. But although Zips and Marcel only see him at like 100 innings and 87 innings, Steamer actually has him pitching 165 innings, but with a 2.1 WAR and a 4.08 ERA. Those are the projections for Ranger Suarez. Then you look at the number four starter, Kyle Gibson. Did you remember that Kyle Gibson was actually an all-star last year? Didn't look like it when he came over from Texas, but with the Rangers, he had a 2.87 ERA and a 6-3 record in 19 starts. Made his first All-Star team for the American League. And then he comes over to Philadelphia, pitches terribly, has a 5.09 ERA, allowed 8 home runs in 69 innings. But the peripherals in both places were the same. His strikeouts per 9, walks per 9, home runs per 9, all of them about the same. He was hit around a lot in Philly. Hits per 9 up to 8.6. From 7.3 with Texas. So he was given up another 1.3 hits per 9 with the Phillies. And the Steamer projections have him as a 1.5 win player. Okay, like an ERA in the mid-4s. For your number 4 starter, I guess that's okay. But they see him more as the pitcher he was in Philly than the guy who was excellent for Texas. But maybe you see in Kyle Gibson a guy who can put together another all-star season, or at least an all-star half. And I will say, Gibson was hurt by Philadelphia's awful infield defense. The infield defense did get better last year for a little while, but it still wasn't very good. And that could still hurt Gibson, perhaps more than anybody else. And then with Zach Eflin, he's a wild card. You just don't know. I will point out that he's only had an ERA below 4 once in his career. And I don't know that you should automatically expect an ERA below 4 with Zach Eflin. So based on the projections, here's kind of what we're looking at. Zach Wheeler, an ERA 3.5 and a 4.2 WAR. Nola, 3.85 ERA, 3.7 WAR. Suarez, 3.8 ERA, 2 WAR. Gibson, 4.50 ERA, 1.5 WAR. And let's say Eflin, 4.05 ERA. Let's say he starts a full season, he gives you 2 wins. It's not a bad rotation, but it's not awesome. You're going to need an offense. You're going to need a bullpen to help out these guys. If I think the most likely scenario is Wheeler and Nola can continue to be elite-level starters. And then I think 3-4-5 are still a question. I'm very intrigued by Ranger Suarez, but I think you have to tap the brakes a little bit about Ranger Suarez as a dominant left-handed starter in this league. You got to see how he does here over a full season starting games. And then I just... The defense has to get a whole lot better with their range at catching the baseball, throwing it accurately for Gibson and Eflin to truly take the next step, because those are ground ball guys, and you need your fielders to field ground balls properly for those guys to have a lot of success. So I don't know what your expectations are for the Phillies rotation. Maybe they could have a 1993 Phillies, everything goes right, explosion of good fortune. And if that happens, the Phillies are going to win the National League East. But we got to see that happen before we can actually... It's just not something you can predict. I was going to say, you have to see it before you can predict it, and then that's not a prediction. I just don't think that's something that you can anticipate actually happening here in 2022. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Mike Ferrin for joining me on the podcast and talking about the Hall of Fame and the labor wars and all that good stuff. Make sure you're listening to Power Alley on the MLB Network Radio on Sirius XM each and every day during the midday. And don't forget to check out our Hittin' Season Patreon. We are at patreon.com/hittin'season. You can check out all of the extra bonus content there. And folks, I want to plug Continued Success a little bit. They're doing a really fun thing where they're going through the mason jar. You know, they got a jar and they have a whole bunch of random Phillies from the rebuild, all their names written on them, and they're pulling a couple out to talk about on each episode of Continued Success. You know, we shouldn't ignore that era of Phillies baseball. It's a lot of fun listening to them talk about like Mark Leiter Jr. and, you know, Heath Embry and Brandon Workman. Even though these guys are names that might make your ears bleed, it's still a fun conversation. You're going to want to check out Continued Success moving forward. It's really an outstanding time. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.